you absolutely need to know odor, how it moves, you know, scent pool, scent cones, and how the environment affects it, positive, negative pressures and vacuum. Like if you can understand how odor and predict, because no, you can't see odor, but if you can predict how it's going to move and how your dog's going to respond to it, you're going to be a lot more successful in putting your dog in productive areas and finding and locating what you're looking for.
Hey guys, check out the 2023 Street Cop Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, Gaylord Convention Center. It's going to be the event of the year. Keynote speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Navy SEAL Jason Redmond, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Marine Corps Special Forces and Leadership Coach Cody Alford, Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff David Clark, and Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's going to be one hell of an event. And on top of that, we have all of our instructors and additional instructors from other companies going to be at the event, giving you everything they know for you to have a successful career and get the results you want to get in the field as a police officer. On top of attending the event, you'll get face-to-face time with every instructor attending the event, and all the keynote speakers will spend time with you. We got special events all week, giveaways, nightlife. It's going to be really, really worth your time, energy, and effort. I promise you, you will not regret it for a second. To register for the conference, check out streetcop.com, click conference, and everything you need will be there on the homepage. If you are looking for a room, just click book a room. The block has been sold out at the Gaylord Opryland Convention Center, but there are many hotels nearby within a walking distance of the event. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity. We will see you there.
You trying to be a street cop?
Welcome to the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm Sean Grogan, the instructor for unmasking hidden facial expressions and body language for law enforcement. Today I have with me Josh. Josh, I'll let you introduce yourself.
I'm Josh, an instructor for all things canine. And basically how I kind of got started into canines is I grew up in like one of the largest police and military training kennels in the world. And I spent a lot of time in there, and I kind of always knew I wanted to be a canine handler on the law enforcement side, but you know, having family in that business kind of drew me in to the dogs. And I started, the longer I worked, the more I was like, you know, hey, I want to work these dogs. I don't just want to be on the training side of it. And, but I was too young to be a cop at that time. So I basically ran some contracts for like, Bengals games was the big one I did, explosive protection dogs. Cause I could do that under the age of 21 until I was about 21. Then I got hired in law enforcement and, became a canine handler, and basically that's what I do now. I'm a canine handler and I do interdiction.
Oh, that's awesome. So you started out, did you do a lot of, I know you said scent work, but did you also do protection work as well, you know, tracking, trailing and things of that nature?
Yeah. So I spent a little bit of time on the law enforcement side and a little bit of time on the military side, but the kennel also had a personal protection thing where celebrities or high profile people, government officials would basically get these dogs, but I didn't have any really part in the personal protection. I mostly did the law enforcement military side.
Can you name any of these celebrities, or is that all highly confidential?
No. So I don't know exactly if they purchased a dog, because I would just see him in passing, but I saw Osborne's, like Ozzy Osbourne's son, I can't remember his name, but he was there. I saw a lot of other country government officials, so like small countries would fly in and they, you know, but more profile people, but I just kind of saw him in passing. It wasn't like a big deal when people came there. I didn't know who a lot of people were. I just knew they were important by all the people they had with them.
That's awesome. So when you did protection work, was it along KMPV lines? Was it like Schutzhund type protection? Those of you who are not familiar with Schutzhund, it's a German dog sport that's spread throughout the world. But is it more along those lines, or was it more realistic training with the, you know, muzzle work and taking the suit and the sleeve off?
Basically in the buildup of the dog, when you're building up the dog, a lot of the stuff would be the Schutzhund stuff, the IPO, IPG, which is all kind of essentially the same thing. It's the same sport, but you would build the dog up that way. But basically, as they were getting ready for the street, you have to start to remove some of the equipment. Or, I mean, because just because a dog's going to bite a suit or bite a sleeve does not mean they're going to bite a person, if that makes sense.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So you have to kind of transition and be like, hey, it's okay to bite people that aren't wearing the marshmallow suit.
Yeah, the equipment fixation. So could you share with us some, we talked about this, we talked shortly about a week ago. We said we'll go over some of the body language of canines. What are some of the signs, the nonverbal signs that we'll see? Because the dog's not talking to you. It's what kind of nonverbal signs you see from a dog before they go and they bite and attack?
Yeah, so I think like the big ones, like we kind of talked about earlier, like you don't necessarily see it in dogs that are trained to bite when they know it's okay to bite people, but like your pet dogs or dogs that cops are going to encounter on calls, those are the ones you're going to see it more of. And typically you're either going to see the aggressive posture or the defensive posture. Aggressive being kind of that tail up, you know, the stereotypical kind of leaning forward, ears up if it's a pointy eared dog. But I mean, as you know, labs can bite too, but
yeah.
That leaning forward, the scruff on their back, all that stuff, standing up, showing teeth, being vocal. And then your defensive stuff, tail tuck, kind of cowering down. They flatten out like a snake, how they flatten their heads out. You see that with dogs, they kind of hunker down. You see the bottom whites of their eyes kind of looking up at you. Like typically you see either of those two things, you're probably going to get bit. And the biggest thing is once you get bit, you'll remember what you saw forever. And you'll be like, ah, that's not a good behavior.
Yeah. I like how you bring up labs too and other dogs. Cause we know there's handlers I know that have had their labs where I'm not trained at apprehension that have had some accidents. And it's something that you always think, oh, look at it. You got the fluffy dog. Do they refer to that out in Indiana as well? The fluffy dogs, as far as your labs and your goldens and stuff like that.
We just call them floppy and pointy for like floppy eared and pointy eared dogs. So that's how we differentiate.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've always heard if it's not a shepherd or a mallard or a Dutch shepherd, it was always, oh, the fluffy dog, the fluffy, you know, thinking yeah, of talking yeah. about your goldens and stuff along those lines.
Some of those labs and golden retrievers are nasty, you know, like, I mean, they'll nuke you.
Yeah. And that's what we talk about. I thought that was a great description. I really like how you brought up like the laying out like a snake. There are times though, where you're just not going to see it, correct? Like you're just not going to have that casting a behavior.
Yeah. There's a, you know, why they do it, I don't know, but you know, there's some dogs that'll bait you in, you know, it's their whole goal. And sometimes you can read it a little bit and sometimes you don't, but you know, I've been tagged, you know, a handful of times by dogs I never saw it coming. But those are obviously those were all either military or police dogs that got me like that.
Yeah. I actually had one that was a shepherd. It's been trained in, I don't want to say Schutzhund work, but personal protection work, right? And it was a chief in a certain agency. I've been there 5 times now. He's hosted me. So I go up there. We grab dinner a lot. And he's like, oh, come by. I still haven't seen my dog. I go, okay. So we go by. We see the dog. And his wife's there. And I'm like, hey, he brings the dog out. And he's sitting there. I go, you think I can approach him? He goes, I don't know. I go, and she's like, oh, well, it's like, no, I don't think so. And I'm like, nah, I'm feeling fucking stupid today, right? So I start walking towards the dog, but I'm not, you know, I see the tails wagging, hackles aren't up. There's no signs. I don't get a growl. And I just move my arm a little bit towards to see what would happen. And he lunges. And when he lunges, I get away enough. He got my jacket, but he didn't get any flesh. And I was like, there was nothing there. I'm sure if you slowed it down, you know, we had the video recording, that tail probably stopped at the moment, but there was no other signs that you could see in real time. So how many times have you been bit, Josh?
I don't know. A lot.
I'm talking about not on the sleeve.
Yep. And it doesn't get any more fun. My least favorite ones are the hands. You know, those are obviously the worst. So my left hand's been messed up a couple times. Most of them haven't been too terrible because they've been in large muscle groups or something like that. But, you know, my worst bite ever was on the hand, and it took a while to recover because I got bit through and through, like, you know, a hole through my hand.
Oh, wow. Oh, the whole way through, huh?
Oh, yeah. So, and it's wild because, you know, it was maybe like January, super cold. So I didn't bleed for probably a solid 10 seconds. Like I got bit, I got the dog off and I was looking at my hand and I was like, you know, almost mesmerized, like the fact that it wasn't bleeding. And then when it started, it took a while to stop. But yeah, that one was a wild story because that dog was super friendly, but he was food aggressive. And what had happened was we were pulling dogs after, because obviously some of these dogs, you got to let them sit for a while or they'll flip their stomach, certain breeds. So he had been in his kennel and he had been fed, you know, maybe 2 hours prior, and he still had a food bowl, but it was upside down. And I walk in his kennel and, you know, he's wagging his tail, happy to see me. I get in there, I get ready to hook him up, and I kick his food bowl to pull it out of the kennel. And there was one kibble underneath it. And he looks down at the kibble and then looks up at me. And I mean, that one I saw because I knew he was food aggressive. And as soon as he looked at that kibble and looked at me, I was like, yep, here it comes.
Oh man.
Yeah. And that was about an 85-pound black shepherd. And he wasn't even trained to bite. That was a single purpose explosive detection dog that did that. And
wow.
Yeah. And he was strong. It took a lot, because at that time I was probably 17 years old, and this, you know, I was 140 pounds, maybe, you know, I was just a teenager, and this is an 85-pound dog that's, you know, been deployed and came back to the kennels, because they were, a lot of those dogs were on contracts, and when the handler switched or something, like, they'd come back.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough, I didn't have anything go through me like that. My dog was also single purpose, narcotics detection dog, but bred dual purpose. But we can't have bad guys getting bit in New Jersey. That's just bad for business, right? It's horrible. So I had a re-gripping. You train with balls or towels, or you've done both? Rolled up towels for scent detection?
Tennis balls mostly. And I mean, not because of any preference, but you know, a lot of tennis balls you get for free. So a lot of the schools, colleges, stuff, they'll give you their used in ball or indoor tennis balls. So they're easy to come by. So I think that's why, that's just kind of what I was brought to. I don't think there's a way, neither here nor there, but we just use tennis balls.
Oh, okay. Cause here in Jersey, a lot of the training's done with the rolled up towel. There are places that I know that will use like the Dutch scent boxes and things of that matter. But the way I was taught with towel tosses. So that remained his reward. You get towels, roll them up. And the one time he re-gripped, we had a new supervisor wanting to see the dog work. So I'm like, oh, okay, come on, we'll go see the dog work, put a hide out. Dog finds the hide. Obviously, he gets rewarded and we start working. Now I'm talking to the supervisor while I'm doing it, not watching. I slow down. He regrips into the hands. And yep. I had to get it cleaned out. I don't know about you if you had him cleaned out, because I was like, yeah, I'll be all right. You know, I went home, I woke up maybe 6-7 hours later, it already started to swell. And the doctor was like, yeah, we got to clean this thing out. And I think the cleaning out of the bite is worse than the bite itself. Would you agree? Or you think the bite itself is worse, or the ones that you've had? Because you've had more than me.
I have luckily never really felt the bite. Like each time I got bit, I never felt it until after. Like I felt the after fact, but you know, I'd get bit because so much adrenaline and all that. I never actually felt any of the bites, even the bad ones. But the one I told you about, the food aggressive thing, the, you know, I kind of give you the PG version, but that dog is what we referred to as a shit spinner. And they would basically drop turds in their kennel and they would spin and play in it. And he would also eat it. So he was super nasty. When I got bit, I got an infection in that hand, even after they cleaned it out, because, you know, it was kind of the culture where I was at, especially with my family being in it, like, hey, you don't need to go to the hospital, you know, so you're fine, wash it out and stuff. And that's what I did. And it swelled all the way up to my elbow. And they were taking the Sharpie and marking the infection. Sorry, they were marking the infection of the redness as high. And they were warning me if it starts, you know, getting pretty high. About the time it got to my elbow and they were running IVs, they were like, hey, you know, if you can't let this get to your heart or anything, so the more it climbs up your arm, the more we're going to have to look into, you know, amputation. And I was like, what? Oh. But I don't think it got anywhere near that bad. I think that was just, I don't know why they would tell me that, but you know how sometimes it is in the medical field. They tell you things that, you know, might not even be that serious, but
Wow, that's something. I thought you guys would just take, you know, corn powder dust or some out there in Indiana and just rub it on there. But they actually have doctors that'll actually do all sorts of things, including amputations in Indiana.
Yeah. Well, thank God they didn't do that. But yeah, with a lot of those dogs that you kind of talk about, you talk about your chief's dog and stuff, and I kind of touched on how you don't see it coming. And, you know, most of that's just because of associations, like with what actually dogs see. And it could have been, you know, I wasn't there and I didn't see what happened, but, you know, to put it in the most easy way to understand is like, these dogs are trained. They understand what equipment is or whatever it might be. And you might have, like, say your wife comes in and these dogs know what bite sleeves are, but she comes in, she's got one of those, she just had shoulder surgery and she's got one of those slings on. Well, you know, he's not being like, oh, she must've just had surgery. He's looking at her like that's a bite sleeve, you know? So they have these associations because they don't critically think. They associate or act off of instinct. That's essentially all these dogs are going to do. And, you know, he might've seen something you did and thought, you know, that, or, I mean, he could also just be a prick, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's one thing you bring that up with. I was lucky. My dog obviously was trained on the sleeve. I got shoulder surgery. And that's actually one of the concerns I had. Yep. Is he going to see this and key up and think, I kind of remember this from Hungary because that's where he came from originally. Well, luckily there were no issues because that would have been a real bitch if getting bit after a surgery on the arm.
Yeah. A lot of those dogs come from overseas. My dog right now is from Poland. So yeah, I mean, we get a lot of our dogs overseas, and, you know, when I was working in the kennels, almost all of them would come from Europe, one of the, you know, Poland, Hungary, Netherlands, all those things.
That's where my dog came from, Hungary, and a lot of other dogs were coming from Europe. And I was always told, when I did Schutz on it, we talked about before, and a lot of dogs were imports there as well. And from my understanding, and I haven't seen it, but anyone that's gone over there, they said the Schutz Hunt Clubs over there is a big thing. Where in the States, if you go to Schutz Hunt Club, right, you go work a dog here, you might have 5 people come on a weekend. Supposedly they'll get like 50 to 100, you know, everybody's in the dogs and they know they can sell them over here in other parts of the world, green, not even trained up, just from the breedings. And then they're, you know, I shouldn't say green. They might have a little bit of imprinting. I don't mean scent imprinting. You understand what I'm saying?
Right,
just kind of, all right, they put them on a sleeve a little bit and didn't do any scent work. And then you get a green dog and we could ship them over to the States for 5-10 grand.
Yep. And some of, you know, and it's not like this across the board or always, it's not, you know, set, but it doesn't seem like you always get the best of what they have. Cause there's so much money in that sport that, you know, they want those bloodlines that, you know, sometimes the US and the police side, like, they might not get the best they have to offer. They, you know, not to say that they're going to give you a crappy breed or a crappy bloodline, but, you know, they, if they're, business is breeding and putting out these dogs, if they have, you know, one of the best bloodline dogs or genetically gifted dogs, like, you're probably not going to sell it. They're probably going to keep it.
Yeah, no, that's the same thought process we've always had here with anyone I trained with in Jersey and in the sports side, as well as police, that, you know, the best dogs in Europe are staying in Europe because they want to breed them. They want to show them off. They're not going to give you their best product because why would they do that when they can continue to work that dog there in sport or breed the dog?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I'm a big proponent of if a dog has a good drive and a dog has a good personality, you can basically build it to do anything that you want. So I'm not too terribly concerned with having, you know, the best genetically gifted dog, because if they have those two attributes, like, I'm happy with them.
And we were talking about the body language of the dog, you know, attacking, and that's kind of, we were talking about pet dogs as well, and just general dogs if you're out on patrol. What about potential handlers out there and handlers that are out there? What are some of the nonverbals you see or cues that you could share with everybody about tracking and trailing?
So, I mean, some of the behaviors and characteristics or body language, those things, a lot of them will carry over, but there are some times that, you know, each dog is going to be different, kind of like people or anything like that. You might have different things, but I mean, you know, everyone knows the head throws and things like that. Like, you know, that's probably the most common change of behavior that you hear people talk about. But, you know, the interesting thing is they're almost every body part in the dog you can watch and gain information from that are going to help you. You just need to know, you know, your dog, especially if you're a handler, like you need to know your dog, because you might have something in one of these behaviors are a lot of times subconscious. They don't consciously have these head throws. And I mean, you were a handler, so you'd understand this. Is sometimes you would have a change of behavior and then the dog would leave it. And they don't realize that they had it. So it's up to the handler to read these changes of behavior, read that body language and see, you know, the tail set and the ears and watch all that and watch what they're doing and know their dog to be able to keep them in productive areas.
Well, that's such a good thing to bring up, that every dog said same thing with human. Everybody's an individual. You have certain things that you see with a lot of humans, and same thing with dogs, but you get that your dog does something different when they cue in. Maybe they hover longer in an area after a head spin, you know, like it's, you call them head throws. Is that the terminology you guys use out there?
I mean, everything's pretty synonymous. I just kind of pick a word, you know?
Yeah, no, I got you. I just didn't know. Cause you know, the different parts of the country use different language, head spin, head throw.
Head throw is probably common in this area, but you know.
Yeah. We always use head spin. And it's one of those things, you get regional differences, but there's so much alike. I mean, we could probably talk for hours after this about dogs. And there's the saying, I don't know if you've heard this saying, there's only two things canine trainers will agree on. It's what the third one's doing wrong.
Yep.
you've heard that too? Or
yeah. I was actually just talking to somebody on social media that was messaging me. He was having, you know, he said his dog was doing well on the street and stuff, but he was getting a lot of pushback on, because he was taking outside trainings and implementing that, and the in-house trainer or whatever didn't like it. And I don't know if there was like a one way to do thing, but you know, then my main philosophy, and I say this in my class all the time, because you know, there's things that I'm going to do that people might think are dumb, you know. But the only things that I think matter is if the dog is proficient. If you have a dual purpose dog, he's proficient in narcotic detection or explosive, whichever, tracking, trailing, and apprehending people. Like if they are proficient in their job, then you're doing it right. So, you know, if it's hard to argue, like guys like Kenny, it's hard to argue that his dog, he might be training his dog to sniff wrong when his dog's hitting kilos, you know?
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my thing. Was I trained all over the state, and I did the national ones too, because I trained with different trainers. I wanted different drugs, different areas, different, I don't want to say methods, because for the most part, scent detection is the same method. You might have different ways how to pattern the dog and things of that nature. Hey, why don't you work this way, counterclockwise as opposed to clockwise, things like that. But for the most part, I think it's great to go and see what other people do. And I trained, I don't know how much you've gone with other agencies. Because in Jersey, you have to go with an agency. You can go other places, but you have to be certified by a trainer in the state of New Jersey.
Yeah. So I do a lot of outside training. My in-house training, we do 20 hours inside my department. And I do that, but I do almost all my training outside and in small groups. And, you know, I travel around and spend my own dime. I like taking or listening to everybody. And, you know, I just like building everyone and taking what I like and doing that. But I mean, the biggest thing in dogs and in training is just knowing your own dog, getting out there and doing it, especially like, you know, especially when you're tracking or trailing, like if you don't know, like all those are going to be blind. If you don't know what your dog looks like in odor and you're looking for somebody and you know, you're in a high risk situation, you're tracking a guy that just committed a strong arm robbery or something like that, and he's bedded down somewhere. You better know what these behaviors are, because when you come up on top, you don't want to get on top of guys, you know, and that's the big thing I tell guys that I train with is, you know, when you're looking for these guys, we're not tracking or trailing them to bite them. We're just trying to find them and figure out where they're at, because, you know, dog's less lethal. You know, you might need a SWAT team or you might need to tackle it a different way. Like we're just using dogs to locate them. We don't need to go diving into bushes and getting dogs killed or ourselves.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast, and it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally, and we also entertain you as well.
Oh, 100%. Now, let me ask you this, talking about tracking. If you've got a Mallee or Shepherd there, let's a dual purpose, or even it's been trained in tracking, right? If you've got a bloodhound that's available, and I'm not saying 20 minutes away available, you've got a bloodhound on scene, would you then put the bloodhound on point and use the Shepherd if it is dual purpose, trained for apprehension? Would you have them stand back, or would you, what would you do in a situation like that?
So we don't have a lot of bloodhounds around where I'm at, but like I would go off of basically what people knew about the dog. Like if somebody was coming up and telling me like, hey, you know, we got this bloodhound and it's phenomenal. Like, you know, his success rate is amazing. He's better than your dog. And if, you know, and if I trusted who said that, then yeah, I'd have that. I'd have the bloodhound take point and I'd run secondary. And in case the bloodhound got tired or whatever, I'd let him run in front and use that, because sometimes you need those apprehension dog, but kind of like what I talked about, like you can have a single purpose tracking dog because, you know, in my opinion, the main goal of looking for high risk violent suspects is not to actually get on top of them. It's to locate them, read the proximity alert, see that they're in the area, you know, use the environment to your advantage and be like, hey, you know, we're here. He's somewhere in this area.
So you talked about before about the facial expressions. We were talking about body language and stuff with the dog. And you were like, hey, you know, different wrinkles in the face and stuff like that I wouldn't be aware of. They actually have, I don't know if you're aware, facial action coding system known as FACTS. They have it for humans, right? That's like when I go over the facial expression class, but they have them not just for humans. They got them for dogs and they got them for chimps as well. And I would love to see what in the future they come up with and what kind of studies, because I haven't really looked into it, but it's something I'd be really interested in what they come up with. What do they notice in the facial movements of dogs before certain things happen, or when they might be fearful, or when they might become aggressive, to actually break that down. But it's one of those things too, you know, the academics are using it, right? Is it something they're going to be able to put into so that the average handler can go out and say, hey, I'm recognizing this at a point?
Yeah. I'm sure it's there, you know, but I'd be interested to see that as well.
So one of the things that we talked about before, and this is probably all the OZUs out there that are not handlers now, but potential handlers, and you want to start a program, your agency doesn't even have a program. What tips? When I started, I was the only dog, and I'll go into what I did, but what are your tips for what should you have together? Who should you speak with? Who should you talk to in your agency to try to get that started?
Well, you're probably going to have to start at the top and try to convince them, because if whoever's running your department, whether it's, you know, a chief, a sheriff, or like a city council or some kind of something like that, like if they don't support it, you're not getting a dog. So, I mean, you're going to have to start there before you even do that. And you're going to have to convince them why. And it's easy to convince why to use a dog. I mean, look around and you see the capabilities of these dogs, especially like, you know, in our area for like tracking, like we have people commit, you know, these major crimes and they run. But, you know, we spend a lot of time on tracking and trailing, depending on what it is, in urban environments, and our dogs find people. So that's a major thing, because you can't let people get away. And same thing, narcotics, you don't want those on the street, and schools and what have you. So, I mean, it's pretty easy pitch, but you're going to have to start at the top.
The major issue I have is that it's a tool that everyone, I think, in the entire country, law enforcement should have available to them. And what I mean by that is there's places where you can't get a dog for 45 minutes or an hour. And I'm not talking about just the drug dealer with kilos in the car, which is important. Now, you want to get, you know, that potential heroin or fentanyl off the street that could kill somebody, but you get that fresh robbery, fresh burglary to a house. How do you tell the victims? Yeah, we just, all right, we're going to collect evidence. We're not bringing a dog out to the scene because we don't fucking have them. We don't have them in the area where I worked. It wasn't something you'd have to actually bring up, like, hey, you think maybe we want a dog out here, but there's just not a lot of dogs. Because Jersey, this it's not a big dog. South Jersey, a little bit more, but that's like another country. Well, that's a whole nother podcast for another time. But we don't have a lot of dogs. But like you said, there's so much. It's just such a resource. You can use it for the hearts and minds during demonstrations. You can use it for these victims. How do you tell somebody, sorry, yeah, we know you were robbed here, and we didn't call a dog because we just don't fucking have them. And it's not something we do here. And you could reach out to another agency for the mutual aid. It can be done all the time, but how many times is it done if it's an agency without a dog or without even a single purpose handler to bring up, hey, maybe you want to get a dog out here. I just think it's something that every agency in a country should have. And it doesn't have to be the apprehension dog, because everybody's up in arms. Oh my God, someone got bit. It's going to look terrible in court. They just robbed somebody and almost murdered them, but they were bit. Did you see their arm? That's horrendous. And that's the shit we deal with over here on the East Coast.
Yeah. And I mean, if, you know, we, especially like for me, I give people every opportunity to surrender, you know, I mean, Street Cop has posted like some of my stuff and like, you know, I give people the opportunity to surrender. And that's the thing, like I give people the option and they choose their own destiny. Like if I tell you to stop, I'm going to give you more than enough time. Like I'm not, it's not like I'm whispering it. I'm going to yell it as loud as I can, get your attention, say it. Cause I don't want my dog to bite people, you know? And I just want them to give up. That's it. Like I'm not out here trying to collect tallies. I want them to give up and I want them to face their fate, go through the justice system. And that's it. I'm just trying to find them and hold them accountable. Not trying to go out there and bite them.
And that's what I think people don't understand.
Yeah. But sometimes that does happen. Kind of like what you're talking about. Like sometimes people do get bit, but I mean, if we're doing our due diligence and we are, you know, trying to de-escalate the situation, like, I mean, sometimes it's unpreventable because there are violent people out there that don't care.
You know, you hit the nail on the head. You don't want them to get bit, but there are violent people out there that will still fight your dog. This state, they sent out something to all the handlers. Every fucking handler in the state had to go fill out this information in every agency. If you had a dog, you had to fill out all this information. And it was written by a non-handler, some fucking bureaucratic moron sends out this thing and says, okay, how many times has your dog been deployed? How many times has it been requested? And I'm like, requested, deployed? Well, I work a single purpose dog. I still had to fill the thing out. And they wanted all the times the dog's been deployed and how many times the dog's bit. And they didn't get the numbers they liked because they were actually trying to get rid of anyone you talk to the higher up in that worked the dog in Jersey. They were like, they're trying to get rid of, the old attorney general was trying to get rid of apprehension dogs in the state of New Jersey. And when they got the paperwork back, they were like, oh, once we get this back, we're going to have an answer in a few months. They didn't get the answer they wanted because they wanted to say, oh, look, these dogs are biting people all over. But they were getting a shit ton of numbers for surrenders. So they didn't get what they liked. And they just disappeared, went up into the fucking New Jersey thin air.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely think there's a, you know, I have a biased opinion. I'm a canine handler. And, you know, this is the path or the trajectory I chose in my life. But I mean, that's exactly how it is. Like there is a need for both dual purpose, single purpose dogs. And, you know, I don't want people to think I'm sitting here being like, you know, anti apprehension canine. I'm just, you know, the world has changed and you'll get sued, you know? And that's exactly how I think of it is, you know, you got to weigh like your liabilities and things and the use of force and, you know, the giving people the opportunity to surrender now. And there's one thing like, is the person an active shooter? Like you don't give those guys opportunities to surrender because you'll get yourself killed, you know, but like, you know, a robbery suspect that's hiding in a dumpster, like, and you get a proximity alert and you know, he's in the dumpster. Like, you know, I'm not just going to walk up there and open the lid and drop my dog in, you know, I'm going to ask him to come out before I do anything like that. But I'm also not going to set myself up for an ambush.
Oh yeah, exactly. And I don't think you're anti-apprehension at all. You said, that's what everybody wants. You want the dog. But the thing is, I don't think people realize you're not going to bring fucking Fido, your fluffy dog out that's not training it and say, oh, he's sent to Texas, but we're going to make him bark and think they're going to get bit. Number one, everybody in Jersey that's a criminal is going to find out, hey, we don't bite dogs here no more. This is bullshit. Number one. Number two, you're not going to put yourself in a dog in that situation. So unless you actually have a dog that can bite, You can't give those commands to get someone to come out. I mean, you could try to bluff them, but guess what? Everybody's going to know. They knew in Jersey, once they get changed laws, they know the laws before probably half the regular civilian population finds out.
The barking thing, you see that a lot. And, I think some of that, like the using the dog as a deterrent, which it absolutely is. I just think sometimes people need to be careful about the application of where they use that. Because a lot of guys will put their dog in the threshold of a door and give canine announcements, like with their head wrapped around a door. And that comes from training, like the basic training of the dogs, these 6, 9, 12 week schools where they're building the dog up and they're teaching them building searches and stuff, but they never back it off. Like in what scenario would you ever, go looking for a hiding violent suspect and wrap your head around the doorway and let them know, like, ready or not, here I come. So, I think people need to be careful about that. Like, let your dog bark, but do it from a place of cover where, and not in a fatal funnel.
That's one thing I think New Jersey does right. It's a police trainer. You have to have worked a dog for a certain amount of years before you can become a trainer here. Now there's the argument that, okay, that's what you need because of tactics like that. Are you going to have someone in the threshold of the doorway, or are you going to go back to your car and call out commands over the loudspeaker so that the whole neighborhood hears it? So when I go ask Miss McGillicuddy, hey, as a witness, what happened? Oh, I heard him. I heard him in my room, and I heard him. I was like, oh my God, I went out and looked. So don't tell me the guy hiding inside the house didn't hear. Now, also, you got someone that, all right, I worked dogs for 5 years and now I'm a trainer. But then you've got someone that's grew up in Holland, has been working dogs since they could walk, and they know dogs. Cause so you're like the best of both worlds, because you've got grew up working around it and you've got the police experience. So that's like the total combination right there.
I did mine's kind of like backwards from like the standard thing. Most guys, become cops, become handlers, run a dog or two or three or four. So, some guys have ran 4 or 5 dogs and been doing it for 30 years, but, and then usually they retire and then they get into either some kind of training or if they start their own business or whatever, what have you. Mine was completely different. I was kind of like thrown into it because I grew up around the dog. Like I saw them, and I was like, it was just kind of part of my life. I had a choice, but I didn't really have a choice. It was just, it's what my life was kind of like, I had family.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And I started working dogs before I became a cop too. I was in my early 20s, started doing shih tzu and personal protection work, but nowhere near the level that you did. I didn't work in kennels because I was like, once you see the kennels, you're like, fucking kennels are disgusting.
Right? Yeah,
like, I mean, they're clean, but like, you're dealing with dog shit. You're dealing with dog feces. It is what it is. And when I say clean, they are still disgusting.
Yeah, there was, when I was working there before law enforcement, there was, they had, probably like 400 or 500 dogs. So, there's a lot of dogs. So they had everything from the military contracts, like the TED program and all these things. So, there was a lot of dogs.
So recommendations for keeping cars, cause you said before you don't like dog hair. So what are your recommendations to keep not only yourself hair free, and also your vehicle and that pet dander that's everywhere.
Yeah. And it's not that I don't like dog hair. I just don't want it on me for no reason or on my lips in the winter if I need chapstick. So I don't want it sticking to my face. All canine handlers know, like, you're not putting down your front windows if you have a dog, cause it's going to suck that hair right up. You only get to drive around with your rear windows down and stuff. But basically what I do, every day before and after, my dog gets in the car, gets out of the car, before I go to work and right when I come home, I have an electric leaf blower and I open all 4 doors and I blow the hair out from the day. And then I leaf blow my dog as well. So I leaf blow him and, make sure they're, I get as much hair and I brush him and stuff. And it does phenomenal. I have a little bit of hair at the end of the shift, but I just blow it out when I get home. And, the big thing is just mud and stuff. Cause we do a lot of deployments. We're pretty busy with our dogs. You could go a day and have 1 or 2 deployments, but you could also go a day and have 17 deployments. So, you're pretty busy with them. So, it's inevitable you're going to get some dirt in your car. but I just try to leaf blow it out. Leaf blower is my best friend.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I've used the electric leaf blower myself, but the quickest way that and the if you want, we had a town garage. You go there, they have the
air pressure thing.
Air pressure thing, yeah, that you use for tires. Because that, yep, that'll push air as well. But at home, always, I didn't do as much as you because I'm like, hair is what it is. Plus, the hours I worked, I wasn't getting in late and waking up all the neighbors with my electric leaf blower.
Yeah, I mean, I live in an area where I don't live in the city I work, so I drive. So I like the cornfield scenario or scenery. So I'm out in the middle of nowhere with my dog. So
yeah, no, it's. The cleaning that, like you said, mud. There's also, I don't know if you've ever, have you ever had the shit inside? The fucking dog had the runs. I've had that. And I had the dog cut his tongue one time after we were training, found the hide. It was in service training. It was after, you know, the initial training, went up to North Jersey, hit his tongue on something. We don't know what the fuck he hit it on. Gave it like 10, 15 minutes, blood everywhere. I'm like, all right, well, tell me we'll stop. Then went to the vet. By the time we get to the vet, I fucking leave training, stopped. But now there's blood all over. Took a picture. I sent it to somebody. I was like, yeah, everybody says you want to be a canine handler, so you got to do canine handler shit, right?
Yeah. Tongue bleeds. I mean, those are pretty common because the dogs will bite them so easily. Or, you know, we have a dog on our department that every time in training, it's not even first training venue, every single time, every single day. And, you know, he's going to listen to this and he's going to know exactly who I'm talking about. His dog bleeds from the mouth within 5 minutes of every single training, every single deployment, whatever it is. He's just inevitable. But, you know, if nobody's ever dealt with it, the worst bleed, in my opinion, is tail bleeds. Like you can't, it's almost impossible to get them stopped and keep them stopped. Like, you know, it's, those are the worst. Like, you know, dogs with those happy tails, they slap them open or whatever. I mean, you could deal with a tail that bleeds for years, you know, a year or two and like be able to get it. And I mean, it might be something where people have to dock them. And, you know, I've seen that before. We had a dog like that, like two, three years of nonstop bleeding. They tried everything with it and he just kept on popping it open because he swung his tail so hard against the kennel. And it's hard because you try to fix the problem, you know, and not just come up with solutions for those things. You got to actually fix like what the cause is. And sometimes it's hard.
It's funny you say that, the happy tail. I hadn't even heard of that term till a few years ago. I go on vacation with my family and they call me from the vet. From the kennel. And they go, okay, yeah. So, you know, before you come pick them up, your dog got happy tail. And I go, okay, like, yeah, I'll be there in a little bit. I'm thinking, what the fuck are you telling me? The dog's wagging its tail while he's happy? Like, I've never heard of the term before. And then I go, listen, they said my dog's got happy tail. What does this mean? And then they're like, oh, we'll bring him out in a second. And he hit the tail against something. And it really wasn't that bad. He's had worse things there, scraping his nose against the kennel because he wants to get out. And it's like one of those things you never even heard of, right? And all of a sudden, I'm going to deal with happy tail in the back. And then he's also tried getting out with the nose. It's, you know, the dog's getting all sorts of things, and they don't like being in the kennel. My dog, when I first got him, was out of control. Ripped the curtains out, busted his nose open, breaking out the crate, broke up the crate. Then I'm like, all right, maybe we'll leave him. I mean, just broke a vacuum cleaner, TV, everything. Because, you know, they grew up in Europe. They've never gotten a bath before in their life, most likely. They come home, you bring them home, smell terrible. We took them a bath, took them another bath. It's like, you know, you're pulling all that shedding pieces out. Just a madness.
Yeah, I mean, dogs, when you first get those dogs, a lot of them, unless it's like a smaller kennel that has less dogs, you know, if you get a dog from a kennel that only has 12 dogs, it might be a little bit different. But especially when these larger kennels, like you're going to get a dog and they're probably going to stink. And just the way it is. They don't have, you know, guys to wash 400 dogs every 3 days or whatever it might be.
So before we take off today, one thing I know we always get asked, and it's one of those things you post on social media, people go nuts for, are book recommendations, depending on what you're into. I got the body language ones. Tom Rizzo gets like leadership, things like that. Is there anything you recommend as far as what people should read as far as canine books?
Yeah. And we talked about this a little bit, like my big recommendation to people, anybody, I get that question a lot as well. And I tell people just read every credible source, if somebody's like, hey, you need to check out this book, or you know the person's credible, they're a good trainer, like I like to take all of everybody's advice and all these different methods and stuff, and then I like to choose what I like, because like we already talked about it, like as long as the dog's proficient in what they're supposed to do, then you're doing it right. So for the most part, as long as your tactics are there or whatnot, but you know, there are amazing trainers out there. Like a good, if you want to get into tracking, trailing kind of thing, following blown human odor and contact points and things like that, and you work in an urban environment, you know, Jeff Shetler has amazing books, amazing trainers. He's a phenomenal, in my opinion. You know, I like what he does with it, because, you know, looking for people in cities on hard surface is harder than looking for somebody that just ran through a grass prairie. So, you know, the odor moves different. The atmosphere affects it. It blows around and, you know, you have sticking points and things. But in another, like a more of a science-based one, Kenneth Furton, Dr. Kenneth Furton, I think he's out of Florida, but you know, he's even mentioned in some case laws and stuff. He kind of debunked the contamination theory of money, if you're familiar with that. But he does some, he has some books on, I believe, scent evidence. Those are probably two that I would say check out if you're interested in those types.
That's interesting you bring up, because I haven't heard of that doctor, but I know I've heard of the contamination of money theory, and we bring out both circulated money and we've had unprinted money. My dog's been proofed off of that's run by, and then I'll go hit on the money that's been, we set up with drugs and they walk right past it. Not the money that's been imprinted with drugs, but the other ones, the circulated money, as well as, and you got to be careful with that too, because working narcotics, or if you've had a drug arrest the day before and you've touched drugs and touched the money, and then, you know, it's always like, who hasn't been around drugs for the last week?
Very specific. And now if you don't want it challenged in court, there's a very specific way to do it, because I mean, you don't want your dog hitting on anything other than contaminated money. And, you know, that contamination theory says that all, you know, dogs are going to hit on it all, but you know, that Dr. Furton thing, you know, he came back and did a study, and a lot of it, like in my class, I talk about it and show people, because there's some stuff in there that it almost sounds like BS, but you know, the Supreme Court has recognized what he says. Like, you can type his name into Google Scholar and he'll pop up on some major cases.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard of him. So actually, two books I told you, because I asked you what your recommendation were talking, there's two books that I recommend. And this isn't so much for the training of the dog or anything like that. It's for a courtroom. Because in Jersey, I found it to be fucking phenomenal to go and testify about a dog, because it's not a dog state. And you go up there and you know your dog, right? You know your dog and you understand dog behavior. You're able to explain things, especially with a jury. I found they don't want to ask more than a couple questions, because then the jury looks at you. Oh yeah, they know. And you're the friendly dog guy. Before, you go in, I was the narcotics detective piece of shit, and people just stare you down. Then I'm going in, it's like, you're all, oh, the dog guy's here. You know, I'm like, yeah, talking about the dog. It's a totally different feel. So two books I recommend: Canines in the Courtroom and Canine Olfaction, Science and Law. The reason being is they're both stuff. It has nothing to do. Yeah, still bring up training. It's not about tactics, but to understand how the olfactory senses work, give you different terminology that you might not use beforehand. You're like, okay, now I'll use this macrosomatic and microsomatic in my reports, possibly, or in testifying to make, hey, I know what this means and what that means. And I understand canine science and behavior.
Yeah, no, knowing dogs, and like, your books are great, because knowing dogs is one thing, but you as a canine handler, and one of my favorite things to do is to testify in court. I love testifying in court, especially when you get those defense attorneys, like, you know, unless you bring in some, you know, you bring in Dr. Furton to cross me about odor, you know, I'm probably going to do all right. But you absolutely need to know odor, how it moves, you know, scent pool, scent cones, and how the environment affects it, positive, negative pressures and vacuum. Like, if you can understand how odor and predict, because no, you can't see odor, but if you can predict how it's going to move and how your dog's going to respond to it, you're going to be a lot more successful in putting your dog in productive areas and finding and locating what you're looking for.
Oh, 100%. That's what you bring up, bringing someone in that knows what they're doing. I've had defense attorneys So what drugs does your dog hit on, detective? And then I turn right to the jury and I go, my dog doesn't hit on drugs. He hits on the presence odor narcotics. I turn back and go, would you like to know what those are? Oh, yeah. One other question. Bye. See you later. Because they don't want to open up that Pandora's box, especially a little bit more during the suppressions because you're just dealing with the judge. But yep. I think especially with the juries, they don't want you in there like being likable, number one, number two, knowing your stuff and then asking questions that they don't know the answers to.
Yeah. Early on when in court and stuff, you know, when I first came into law enforcement, you know, maybe had my dog like a year or two, I would get questions, especially locally, like in local court. They would question me more because it looks like I'm like a 13-year-old that taped facial hair on his chin. But so they would ask me a little bit more, but you know, now I don't, they basically ask me if my dog alerted to the odor of a narcotic. And then basically I say, yeah. And then they're like, all right, nothing further. And that's it. And I leave.
Awesome. So before we get going, bring up what classes you got coming up in the next couple months that handlers or potential handlers can, because wouldn't that be good to go in and say, yes, not only do I want to be a handler if that position's up, but also if you want to start a unit, show to a class like this and say, I've taken that initiative, proactively shown up to a class like yours and learned as much as possible, even though I don't do this job and it's not 100% I can get this job.
Yeah. And one thing before I get in my classes, because I do get this question a lot, and I told you, guys wanting to be canine handlers, and, you know, as quick as I can to kind of answer everyone that's looking to get into those and that's sending me these messages that I haven't quite been able to address them all. But, you know, you need to know what your canine unit is looking for, like Dennis talks about reverse engineering a lot. So you need to know what they're looking for and mold yourself to be that person. You know, being a canine handler is one thing, but being a good canine handler is another. So it's completely time committed. You know, the standard 20 hours, you know, might not do it for you. You know, I train with my dog. It's a little bit different for me because I'm passionate about it. Like I love it. It's fun for me. Like what I would do in my downtime is go work dogs. Like it's just what I like to do. So, you know, I put in all this effort to do that. And I think it'll help you get selected if you are committed and proactive in doing that, helping, showing up, volunteering, you know, decoying for your guys, asking them how you can help them. And then another big thing is, especially if you're looking to get a dual purpose dog, you need to understand use of force, the Granby Connors, all, you know, in dogs, it's liability. You know, you're going to be put in more liability situations than any other position in law enforcement with a dog. So you need to understand that. And if you can show your department, like, hey, look, I don't have that many use of forces. I'm good at de-escalating things like that. Like I'm not trying to get a dog just so I can go out and bite people. Like, you know, I'm going to try to de-escalate and all these things. And, you know, it's going to help you be a good candidate for them.
Bringing up the being passionate about it, I think that's, you have to have that in that type of niche. It's not something every cop gets. It's not a huge niche out there. That's not a lot of cops that are canine handlers, and it is wanted, but people don't realize the work that goes into it. And you got to have that passion if you're going to have a great dog out there. One of the things I had heard about when they've interviewed potential canine handlers is they bring in a stuffed animal dog and they have it sit somewhere and they tell the potential handler, they go, hey, praise this dog for me. And what's everybody going to do? Because everybody's embarrassed. Good dog. Oh, good dog. And maybe the word, you got to be in there, good boy, you know, get that high pitch. So if you ever come across that and you're a potential handler listening, you better go in there like you want that. Talk to it like a baby that you've seen for the first time that's related to you, and you're just so excited to be there. Would you agree on that? That's something you gotta show.
You see it in my body cams all the time. I'll, you know, get these apprehensions and stuff, and I'll be yelling at a guy, you know, giving him commands and stuff, and I'll take my dog off and immediately go from yelling at this guy to the most high pitched, you know, happy thing, like patting him on his side, like good boy, Baba, like, you know, running back to the car, like, and he's, you know, all happy and stuff. Like, you got to show them they're doing a good job, like, because it's fun. All this stuff, it's fun for them, especially you know, alerts on cars and stuff. Like, they love these things. Like, it's their favorite thing to do is get out there and hunt. You know, the big thing that's always stuck with me, and I think this, you know, when I'm doing anything else, I can be sitting at my house and I always think about trying to get better with my dog or make my dog better. Because you'll start seeing things like success, and success is, you know, the number one key ingredient to complacency. You know, once you become successful in something and you start doing real well and you're finding all these people and walking around like, oh, look how good I am. Like, and you're like, I don't need to train anymore. And that's, you know, that's the biggest poison in law enforcement is, you know, building that dog up to be something and then riding your success high and then just plateauing. Like, you know, and that's probably the hardest part in law enforcement or in the canine law enforcement that I think is you get to that point where you do well and you ride that success and, you know, you don't want to get stuck there. You want to continue to train and out see when you run out of IDs, you know, go out to these other places or other trainers or handlers that are having success and see their ideas and, you know, take some of those ideas and see if you can change your trajectory and, you know, continue to build.
That's a great point. It's kind of overcoming your own ego.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, hey, yeah, I'm not, we might've done this, but there's still more to be done. Same way when you're praising the dog, oh, I can't look a certain way. You just do the best you can and get over yourself to do it.
You cannot have an ego because you will learn things from people that you do not expect it. You know, like I've learned things from guys that knew nothing. And, you know, I try to teach them everything I know about some kind of topic. And I learned something from them. You know, I'm like, you know, I never, like, they might explain something that they saw in their dog. And I might be like, I never thought of it that way, or I never understood. So I try to learn everything from everybody. You know, I'm not here to pretend like I know everything. I want to learn everything that everyone has to tell me. I'm going to take it all. And if I don't like it, I'm going to toss it out. But, you know, I want to hear what everyone has to say.
Really good stuff. So what classes do you have coming up, Josh? Let everybody know. There's a potential handlers as well. If this is something you want to get into, I definitely recommend be able to go in and say, I've gone in this class because this is how much I want this job or position.
Yeah. So January is a busy one for me. February, I jump over to Wisconsin, but my first 3 months in this, I got quite a bit of classes. They were mostly up north though.
Nice. It's, you're going to realize real quick, that's a mistake because you're going to freeze your ass off. And I've tried to avoid that as much as possible. Minnesota, I was in April and that was terrible. I was in March in Michigan and I'm like, yeah, we'll try to do the South at that point. Stay in Texas.
Yeah, that Hibbing, Minnesota one, talking to the guy that kind of set that up, and he's doing awesome, awesome work. And I, you know, I've been talking to him a little bit and, you know, he sent me a picture of what it's like up there right now. And it's like snow, winter wonderland kind of deal. And I was like, whoa, man, like that, but Hibbing's up by the Canadian border. So,
oh,
yeah, man, it's going to be icy. So, yeah,
but you know, the dogs will love it. Oh, right? They love that shit. You're like, I want to, and they're out there running amok.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it, but I'm not looking forward to hopefully it's not like -20 or anything like that. So I don't know exactly what northern Minnesota is like. I've never been there, but we're going to find out real quick. So,
well, good luck out there with the cold. I'm sure they'll be happy to have you. And thanks for doing this, Josh. I think this is a lot of great information passed on to potential handlers and handlers that are out there.
Anytime. I enjoy talking. I can talk forever. So
sounds good. Thanks, Josh. Stay safe.
All right, you too. See ya.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher. So you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.